El podcast fue el primer proyecto audiovisual de podcasting al aire en la televisión pública de Colombia y estrena una quinta temporada. Este año contaremos con análisis, invitados muy especiales y muchísima música. Será una conversación interesante. El podcast Forever.
Vamos a arrancar la temporada con una figura muy importante de la música en los Estados Unidos. Su nombre es Jack Antonoff, un joven de 39 años de edad de la ciudad de Nueva Jersey que comenzó su carrera muy temprano en la vida como músico, arreglista, compositor, guitarrista y que recientemente se ha vuelto muy famoso gracias a su trabajo al lado de la artista norteamericana Taylor Swift, con quien empezó labores en el álbum 1989 en el año 2016. Posterior a eso, trabajó con ella en el álbum Folklore del año 2020 y este año, en 2024, se ganó el Grammy a Álbum del Año por su colaboración con Midnights. Antes de tener esta conversación increíble con este 11 veces ganador del premio Grammy, compositor, como guitarrista y más adelante como productor, él aparece paralelamente a la artista Lana Del Rey, quien por esa época también estaba apareciendo en el radar con un álbum llamado Born to Die y que fue producido por un hombre muy famoso en aquel momento llamado Jeff Basker, quien había trabajado con Kanye West. Y menciono a Lana porque después de la producción de Basker en Born to Die, Antonoff se unió al equipo de productores de Lana Del Rey y fue así catapultando a la artista de la ciudad de Nueva York a una fama inconmensurable. Su álbum Did You Know That There's a Tunnel Under Ocean Boulevard fue uno de los discos más importantes del año 2023 según la crítica y es producido por Mr. Antonoff. Antonoff comenzó su carrera en el año 2012 profesionalmente hablando con una banda de indie rock de Nueva York llamada Fun. Ahí se ganó el primer Grammy en ese año, 2012-2013, por una canción llamada We Are Young junto a una joven artista emergente llamada Janelle Monáe. Posteriormente montó una banda, un proyecto que inició como solista, lo cual nos va a contar en el programa de hoy, llamada Bleachers. Bleachers es el motivo de esta conversación, su cuarto larga duración con esta banda que es versátil, diversa, popera, punkera, rockera, con muchos tonos de la década de los 80, con algo de New Wave, con ese espíritu de los New Romantics de la década de los 80, de artistas como los Pretenders, de artistas como los Romantics, de artistas como Blondie, pero también con un sello muy personal y muy auténtico. Mr. Antonoff además se ganó el premio Grammy a Mejor Productor en 2023, lo cual lo ubica como el segundo productor en la historia de la música norteamericana en ganarse ese premio luego de Quincy Jones en 3 ocasiones consecutivas. Es un poco atrevido decirlo, pero yo creo que vale la pena hacerlo y siento que Mr. Antonoff es el Quincy Jones de esta generación, de la generación de millennials. La conversación que van a ver en la noche de hoy es una charla muy interesante con una figura esencial para entender la sensibilidad de la juventud moderna, que pensaríamos que está solamente concentrada en la música urbana o en la música popular y que en realidad alcanza unos niveles de sofisticación en el pop, en la balada, en el espíritu ochentero y setentero, gracias a Mr. Antonoff, que trae este disco con canciones muy emocionantes en una era en que parecería que ya la música no es tan natural y tan orgánica como dicen por ahí, con saxofones y baterías. Es un disco increíble, el álbum homónimo de Bleachers, y aquí está entonces el ganador 11 veces del premio Grammy en exclusiva para Canal 13, Mr. Jack Antonoff en el podcast. Congratulations on everything. It's been such an amazing career.
Thank you.
Tell me the history of Bleachers as a band, how you met the guys.
I started the band alone, and I made the first album in a very lonely way. And I finished it and I was like, I need a band. This is a band. And so one of my old friends from New Jersey, who is our original drummer, started helping me find certain people to put them together. And it's evolved into this kind of incredible band that it is. And it's just, the whole thing has been a crazy surprise. Like, a perfect example of how Bleachers has evolved is when I first started working with Evan, who is in the band. I didn't even know he played saxophone. He came into the band to play synths. And then one day he was saying, oh, I can play saxophone. I didn't know he's like one of the greatest living saxophone players. And so that has obviously had a huge influence on the band. But it's just been, you know, it's 10 years now. It's this really beautiful evolution.
But you have two saxophones on this album, right?
Yeah, so we added another one on the last album. We added a sixth member, them.
Why?
Because I liked the interplay of, I like when like things talk to each other, and it's one thing to have one saxophone, but with two, it's like they're kind of speaking to each other and they play around each other. And it's a lot like life. Like sometimes they're in sync and then sometimes they're out of sync, and sometimes they're talking, sometimes they're yelling, sometimes they're whispering. There's a lot of like, it's very alive to me to hear that.
How'd you come up with the idea? I mean, how does this idea grow in your head where you...
I don't know. It's just there. Same thing with drummers. I mean, I have two drummers. Like, I just like... I love communication and I love community. And I just like seeing, you know, I don't want to have a standard band, guitar, bass, drums, you know, standard. I hear... Even when I record, I do things different. So I want that to be felt on stage.
Are there any new musical influences on this new album?
Really just the band, which is also why it's self-titled. I mean, in the past, I would bring in a lot of influences and kind of wear them as armor just to get to whatever the next phase of me was. But something happened on this album where I was just like, every reference I was making was kind of from our own mythology, you know, talking about how we play something on tour, or talking about this experience, you know, and that made me realize, oh, like, I'm ready to plant this flag of a self-titled album.
What role does nostalgia play in this new album? And how do you balance nostalgia and innovation?
Not a lot for me, because in the past, I always felt like I was rocketing from the past to the future, like future, and then my past, and the future and the past. And for some reason, this album, I felt just right now. So the whole thing is extremely present for me. It just feels very like you're sitting in a room with me when I hear it. That's what I feel like. And I never felt that way before.
Did getting married have anything to do with the songs in this album, with writing the songs?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a big thing. Theme is deepening of relationships and big commitments, getting married, the band reaching the point that it's reached. There's a lot of connective tissue between those two concepts.
Let's talk about the growth of the band. You just mentioned the growth and, you know, the importance of that growth. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
It's just something that you can't know until you have it. And in our world, so many things are so fast. You want something, go. You want something, go. You want something, go. You want this, go get it. And a band is just a thing that can't be faked. You know, when you get up on stage, you just either know how to play like there's no tomorrow, or you don't. And it takes so long. I've been in bands my whole life, and bands just get better and better and better and more vital. And so I'm just like proud to be in a band at this point that is at that level.
What's the hardest part of being in a band?
Hardest part of being in a band is, I mean, it's like a many-way marriage. So managing everyone's lives and staying on the track together. Because if you can stay on the track and you can keep it about the friendship and the music, then anything is possible and you can play in these brilliant, brilliant ways. So that's the hardest part, is just keeping it as a unit.
How long would you say then that the new album took for you to just, you know, assemble?
Well, there's like two parts of an album. There's like when it really started, but you're always sort of like writing little ideas, having ideas. And then the real beginning of an album to me is when you actually understand what it is and you're starting to put it together. That was a year. it took a year from, okay, I know what this album is. I know what I'm saying. I know how I'm saying it. I know how I'm going to record it. I have it all in my head. And then you just have to, it's like looking at a mountain. It's like, I see the mountain and now I just have to get to the top. But there's things on here that I've been tinkering with for 2 years or 3 years. But that's just sort of like, it's like the difference between this, like just floating and understanding.
Those ideas that had been tinkering about for longer than a year, can you tell me where they are on the album?
Like a song called Call Me After Midnight had been tinkering around for a while. There's a song called The Waiter, which ends the album, which is like I knew was the end of something. I didn't know how it related. And then once you understand the album, that's when you start to rework the sound and the lyrics. Like, oh, this is the piece of the puzzle, but here's how it fits in. What are other ones like that? There's a song called We're Gonna Know Each Other Forever that a piece of I had for a while. But it's usually the ones that come out of thin air, like the songs like Me Before You, Tiny Moves, Jesus Is Dead, these like statement pieces of the album that you just get and you're like, got it. Now I can understand what things from back here I can pull to the front and what things just stay back there.
About your musical relationship with Lana Del Rey, who's a key part in Alma Mater.
She's just one of my great musical relationships of my life. I feel like we can do anything together. Very rare to just be able to get in a room and feel like anything can come out of thin air that will thrill you.
Yeah, it was so, it's so revealing. Alma Mater is so revelatory of your relationship with her because of its simplicity and yet the feeling of grandeur that you get out of the song.
It's like secret grandeur. I love that song and I love the way it sounds because it sounds like what it's like to sit in the room with us. It really does.
Este proyecto, conocido como Bleachers, arrancó en el año 2014 después de que Mr. Antonov se fuera de la banda Fun y por eso teníamos dos canciones con las que lo reconocimos y lo conocimos. La primera de ellas fue I Wanna Get Better y la otra fue We Are Young. Este fue un disco que él argumentaba en aquel momento rendía homenaje a la cultura cinematográfica de la década de los 80 y en especial a uno de los directores más notables de esa década que hizo películas para adolescentes tan famosas como Ferris Bueller's Day Off, como Mi Pobre Angelito, Home Alone. También Mr. John Hughes fue el director de esas películas y también de películas muy importantes como The Breakfast Club. Así que Antonov decía en el año 2014 que Bleachers se llama así en honor a Hughes y que además buscaba rendirle mucho honor a esa sensibilidad y a esa estética de la década de los 80 que todos amamos con pasión. Luego de eso, cuando se metió a grabar este primer larga duración, quiso también estrechar un poquito los lazos entre la música electrónica que estaba saliendo de Gran Bretaña en el año 2013, lo que llamaban el house de garaje o el garage house, que tenía como representantes más visibles en los Estados Unidos y en el mercado mundial a los hermanos Lawrence de Disclosure y la música indie rock que se había puesto muy de moda después de la explosión de MySpace con bandas como Arcade Fire. Así es que el primer disco es una combinación de esa nostalgia ochentera, del presente de Disclosure y del house de garaje de Gran Bretaña y la música independiente y rockera folclórica de Canadá. Entonces, Mr. Antonov y su etapa como productor en el podcast por Canal 13.
Is there anything in particular that you feel you could improve as a musician, like I mentioned before, you know, as a songwriter, a singer, a performer? You know, is there one thing that you say, I could be better at this, you know, like much better than what you already are?
I don't think of it in terms of like better or improve. I think about it more like there's just a place that you're trying to access and you just get there or you don't. You know, you either get there to that special place and the song comes out and the performance happens and you get there or you don't. So I just focus on it's a little bit black and white in that way. Like it's just a feeling inside me. Like I get there or I don't. If I don't get there, it doesn't come out. So I don't think to myself, oh, I want to get better. I think to myself, I have to just keep finding that place from wherever I am in my life. And that's always been something that's very easy for me, not to find a place, but to know when I'm there. Because when I'm there, I'm just thankful. I just know, oh, there it is. That's the song. I got there by the grace of God. I got there again. And then you have that fear. Was that the last time? And you can't fabricate it. So for me as an artist, one of the biggest thing that I focus on is not getting better, but just allowing myself to be in a position where I can access that place. And if I'm lucky enough to access that place, making sure I'm around a microphone.
And it's fascinating because at the same time, you've tapped into the soul of an entire generation of people around the world. It's really profound, the impact that your music has had over the course of, I don't know, 15, 20 years. You know,
it comes from such a small place, which I always think is so interesting. Literally, either comes from here or comes from a small room. Like I don't have a very big life in terms of how I make it. It's not very grand. It's small. And I think that's nice because I think something that people respond to is this yearning and this dreaming in the music. And I always, when I make music, I'm not standing above people. I feel myself standing with them. You know, it's like a conversation.
Has it always been that way in terms, for example, of songwriting? Like, have you noticed that you're, obviously when you do something often, you get better at it, you know, but has it always been simple?
But I don't think that about songwriting. I think you get better at the things around it, you know, like how to capture it, how to this and that, you know, how to structure it. But I think the thing, like the real thing in the middle that is the thing that connects with people, I just think it's this thing that just comes out of nowhere. And it's true because you could do it your whole life and then turn around and a 13-year-old kid could write the best song you ever heard. Or Bob Dylan with Rough and Rowdy Rays, that late in his life could make one of my favorite albums ever. It's so random. It's not a skill. And I think that's why some people are driven crazy by it. You can hone the skills around it. This is how I like to record my voice. This is how I like to structure things. Oh, I could try a key change here. You know, if the verse starts on the one, maybe the pre starts on the and. You know, you can find these little things, but they're really bullshit because the real thing, deep in that is the expression of the soul that connects to people, comes or it doesn't. And that's why I think a lot of people do this like fake ego thing because we're all involved in a kind of work that I can't go into a room and write you a song. I mean, I can, but it might not be a song. It might sound like a song, but it won't feel like a song. A song is something that is very, you just know it when you hear it. And, you know, so sometimes I'm jealous of people that whose life's work, oh, I build tables. I can go and build you a table. I'm a magician. I can do a trick. Songwriting is not like that. It's very elusive. And the writer is not the one in control.
It's mysterious. Very mysterious. Very.
And that's why I always think it's funny when people have ego about it, because it's the most humble work in the world.
Yeah. What's your
favorite? And all my favorite songwriters and all the greatest geniuses that I've met are always sort of like, hope I get another one.
What you like the most about Rough and Rowdy Ways?
Vital and alive. And I think in our culture, we have this idea that like an old person can only do, it just feels right in that moment. It feels like, feels vital. And I think that that's what I love about music, is that even though the industry can be very young focused, it really is a bit ageless. You know, I mean, why the fuck did Kate Bush running up that hill speak to all those kids for no reason? You know, like music just comes out in different ways, and a song from here, a song from there, a song a kid wrote, a song an old person wrote, a song a middle, it's just this thing that's in the wind that just catches people. And when I heard Rough and Rowdy Rays, it just knocked me off my feet.
Yeah. How do you manage to get so many things done? Producing, songwriting, performing, and actually being good at so many of those things.
Interesting. I don't feel like I get that many things done. Sometimes I feel like I wake up and go to the studio and kind of wait for ideas. So I often feel surprised when I look back at what's come out.
Because you had such a busy year. And, you know, I just kept asking myself, you know, I have to ask Jack how he gets so much stuff done for other people and still have enough time for himself to just put an entire album out. I mean, and actually, like I said before, you know, and I'm sorry for insisting, but just being so good at it, because I heard the album and it was like, wow, how do you pull it off, man?
Well, I think some of it's an illusion, because a lot of these things are in the works for a long time, but then they sort of come out in clusters, you know, so I almost see them as like planes to take off, you know, like they're there and then, you know, I'm not building the plane before it takes off, you know, it's like that was done a while ago and then it takes off and it feels like it comes out of thin air. But, you know, like there's space in me for both. And they occupy different parts of me. And I like having the ability to work on my music or work on someone else's music, because it feels like I can move around and just go with my gut and not overthink things and just be like, okay, this is how I feel about this. Let's make this happen. This is how I feel about this. Let's make this happen. And I think that so much about being an artist is revealing that deep gut feeling, you know, that's kind of all we have is to say, this is how I feel. This is what it sounds like. This is what it sounds like to be me.
Ya después de eso, en el año 2014, empezó a incursionar en el mundo de la producción y se volvió una figura esencial para entender el pop como está en estos momentos, pegadísimo por todas partes. Y la primera persona con la que tuvo la oportunidad de colaborar y a quien le ayudó a brincar de género y de formato, un atrevido y muy controversial momento de su carrera, fue Taylor Swift. Antes de Jack Antonoff, Taylor Swift estaba metida en la música popular estadounidense, lo que llaman la música country. Y después de que llegó Antonoff, Swift hizo ese brinco hacia lo pop y se convirtió así en una superestrella global, como lo es hoy en día. De manera que mucho de lo que ha hecho Taylor Swift se lo debe a Jack Antonoff y a su visión dentro del estudio. You've been close to the success of Taylor Swift, of course, obviously. Is it about the songs? Is it just about the songs?
She's the greatest songwriter, you know, and no matter how successful she gets, she just keeps digging deeper and deeper and deeper. And that's the only lesson there, is kind of like what we've been talking about. It's the songs. It's the songs, it's the stories, and it's the vulnerability.
Couple last questions to ask you now that you mentioned the industry. One of them was has to do with something you said to Jimmy Fallon in the Tonight Show that caught my attention, about how excited you are about the moment the music industry is going through, especially your take on the fans caught my attention really, really hard. Who you say, you know, they finally determine, you know, the fans finally determine who's successful and what, or what is successful and what isn't. Is that really happening, or are we headed towards a more consolidated music world because of streaming?
Well, I think there's always a bad side to the things, but the thing that I notice as someone who interacts with the sort of like industry side of it is, over the past 10 years or 15 years, there was a lot more conversations of this is what we're going to do. And now I notice the industry saying a lot more like, let's see what the fans say. You know, we can pick the songs you want to put forward, but let's just see which ones that they fall in love with. And that to me is an inherently good thing. I think there's a lot of darkness and a lot of stressful stuff that comes with streaming. But the thing I was remarking on was, I just like, and I've noticed it with some of my own music, the power that the audience has to just wrap their arms around a song, you know, easily. You don't have to call the radio station anymore. You know, you can just, you feel people's collective unconscious. Why did everyone just go to this weird song? And then the dark side is what the industry will do with that data and how they'll try to fuck around with people and sell them shit. But that piece of it is interesting.
What's your favorite song on this album today and why?
Today, it's We're Gonna Know Each Other Forever, because it just feels like if you just open me up, that music would play. It feels so sad, but also hopeful and strange. And it just feels like you're in a room with me. And that's really my biggest goal.
What's your take on TikTok and the whole Universal Music pulling their music out of their thing?
It's classic music business stuff. It's like you have for 5 years, every label said, this is, you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this. Then one day out of thin air, without alerting anyone, it was gone. I don't really know exactly what they're fighting for because the deal isn't very public, right? And I always think when we don't know the deal points, there's a reason. So all I know is this. In my lifetime in music, I know that the artist is the last person to be paid. And I think that it's a better world when we make the job of art a very honest one. And in my experience, I was told from a very young age that unless I made it very big, I would never be able to have a family. And I got very lucky, but not everyone does. So I'm just always pushing for a way that people can live their lives as an artist and don't have to have this lightning in a bottle career. And so whether the TikTok thing is good or bad, we don't know yet because we have so little information, which makes me think something fishy is going on. But what I do know is that when I see things like that and when I see artists not being included in decisions, it reminds me of how often the artist is the last person that the industry thinks of.
Thank you for taking the time. It's been a pleasure.
So nice to talk to you. Yeah, can't wait to come down and see you guys.
I hope to. I look forward to seeing you perform here in Bogota, Colombia, South America. Take care.
Take care, sir.
Bye.
Y hasta aquí esta edición del Canal 13. Muchísimas gracias por acompañarnos. Mi nombre es Alejandro Marín y nos vemos en una próxima ocasión.
Este contenido es financiado con recursos del Fondo Único de Ti.